This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today, for the Irish Studies series, my guest is Associate Professor of History at the University of Limerick, Kira Bernack. Kira has recently published a book with Oxford University Press in 2022, Ordinary Lives, Death and Social Class, Dublin City Coroner's Court, 1876-1902. This volume focuses on the evolution of Dublin City's coroner's court and on Dr. Louis Brine's first 2 years in office. Wrapping itself around the 1901 census, the study uses gender, power, and blame as analytical frameworks to examine what inquests can tell us about the impact of urban living from life cycle and class perspectives. Coroner's inquests are a combination of eyewitness testimony, expert medical, legal language, detailed minutiae of people, places, and occupational identities pinned to a moment in time. The subjects of Dr. Brine's court were among the poorest in Ireland. And apart from common medical problems inherent to lower socioeconomic groups, this book covers preventable deaths from workplace, accident, neglect, domestic abuse, and homicide. This is a book about death that in the end tells us about daily life in Dublin at the beginning of the 20th century. So before we delve into all of this, the first thing I want to do is to welcome our guest. Kira, welcome.
Thank you very much, Roberto. It's lovely to be with you and to have a chat with you again, my fond colleague.
Let me start with a very basic question. Can you tell us something about your background and, more importantly, about the origins of the book?
Well, I began working on coroner's records in Ireland back in 2011 when I started looking at unknown and unnamed infant dead. And these are children that are listed in civil registration of death records in Ireland. And to explain the unknown, as in parentage unknown, a body is found and handed over to the police, and invariably it ends up being subject of a coronial court inquiry. When it's an unnamed infant, what it means is that the mother is apprehended at some point or another. So it's a child that hasn't been baptized or named in any way. And in order to explain that infant mortality, what I started to do was look at coronial court inquests. And I conducted this work with Professor Eunan O'Halpin at Trinity College Dublin, and we published a few articles about it. And it really piqued my interest about, and at that point we were looking nationally, we were looking at about 900 unknown and unnamed infant dead over a kind of a 16-year period. And I started looking at the survival of coronial court records in Ireland. And as you are aware, Roberto, we had a devastating fire in the four courts in 1922, which destroyed an awful lot of our court records. And the data set I was looking at with UNAN was national. And what I discovered when I was looking at those records was that, first of all, the records were very patchy and we don't have full coverage for the entire country. And what I also found was that the Dublin records had a fairly decent survival. And it probably has something to do with the fact that there was a long-standing coroner in Dr. Louis Aloysius Byrne, who was there from 1900 up until 1932. And that may have something to do with the survival, the better survival of the Dublin records. But again, even that data set is actually quite patchy. The full inquisitions are not extant. The registers are, the morgue registers are, the coroner's registers are, but as historians of Ireland, we deal with Apache data all the time in Apache archive. So it piqued my interest because these inquest returns piqued my inquest because what I found in them was an explanation for the social circumstances surrounding these cases that were suspected cases of infanticide. But of course, what the inquisitions reveal is that many of those early infant deaths, neonatal and infant deaths up to 12 months, were as a result of dire social circumstances. And sometimes women being presented with the most awful of decisions that a woman has to make in situations of dire poverty. And they're real heartbreaking cases. And then I started looking further at the coronial court records because they're just they're an incredible data set, particularly if you're interested in the history of poverty.
So this is a book about death, to be honest. And I think the readers will find the book really focusing on the question of death. And yet, it is actually a book about everyday life, because what you do in the book is to tell the story of Dublin in a specific period of time through basically the coroner's records and, you know, through people that have died. Now, can you tell us how did you develop this idea? Because I found it extremely interesting that, you know, you decided to look at this coroner's record, which at least... in my experience, is not exactly the first source of historical information that you want to look at.
Again, Roberto, that's a very astute observation on your part. But when you're looking at poor Irish people in particular, they don't leave memoirs, they don't leave diaries, and they leave a very faint impression on the historical record. So we have to find their voices elsewhere. And what I found, particularly, I've been working on the history of death and poverty for a few decades now at this stage. And what I found in records of death is that it tells you a lot more about life. Surviving relatives, even in obituaries or in death notices, it's about the living as opposed to the dead. My son, the engineer, that old joke of the woman running up and down the beach saying, "Help, help, help! My son, the engineer, is drowning," and no mention of the son's name. So it's a way of in these records of death, it's a way of family members, I suppose, eking out levels of respectability, and in some respects, kind of salvaging whatever good name the dead person had, and particularly if it was a relative. I mean, we find, like I found in several of the records of, you know, say, child deaths, that you know, there's respectability indicators peppered throughout, and invariably by the Dublin Metropolitan Police, because these police officers, these constables, were just a small step above the subjects of the coronial court inquiries. And I should probably clarify that coroner's records really are, the Dublin City coroner's records, I should say, are the records of the deaths of the poor and the destitute of Dublin City. So if you're ending up as a subject of a coronial court inquiry, either you have been the victim of a violent attack or assault of some kind or another, but that's only a small proportion of the cases coming before the coroner. By and large, they're mundane cases of somebody dying at home because they've neglected their health or neglected the health of a child, or were perhaps unaware that the child was that sick, or perhaps holding off before going to seek medical assistance because they couldn't afford it or it wasn't accessible to them, or perhaps they had a plurality in terms of how they engaged with medical healthcare and maybe looked to traditional remedies as opposed to going towards what we might now term modern healthcare or evidence-based healthcare. So anyway, what I found in looking at these records was that very definitely, coming back to your point, is that they tell us an awful lot about life, about living circumstances, about, you know, the rooms people died in, about the amount of food they consumed that day, or whether or not they had eaten anything that day, or whether or not somebody had given them food, or a neighbour said, oh, there was no food in the house and I gave them food, or I gave him a cup of tea because he was cold and destitute. And, you know, it really is an incredibly rich source, particularly for a historian like me, because I'm always looking for records pertaining to ordinary people and ordinary lives. So I went off on a rant there. My apologies, Roberto.
No, it was great. And actually, this, you know, ties perfectly with my next question, which is some sort of idea of setting the context. So we talked about, you know, the city of Dublin and the coroners that are basically the main characters of your book. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about Dublin at the beginning of the 20th century, and also about the coroner, who is the central figure of the book, Dr. Luis Aloysius Byrne.
Okay, well, I'll start off with Dr. Louis A. Byrne. He really is a central character in this story. And he starts out himself as a clerk in a distillery in Dublin. And then he moves into a job in the accountancy department in the local authority, in the municipal authority, and in Dublin Corporation. And he goes to night school and earns his licentiate from the Royal College of Physicians, and he's gets a job then in Jervis Street Hospital, and then he becomes a surgeon, a very well-known surgeon in the city. And I suppose he's always looked down upon because he doesn't go to through the what we might consider a more traditional route. He's even in his obituary, a comment is made about how he had gone to, you know, gone to one of the sham certificate schools. In fact, the Ledwick school that he had gone to was under review for, you know, giving certificates to people who hadn't attended school at all. And actually, Laura Kelly writes about this, and he is looked down upon. As against people who might have gone abroad or who might have gone to Trinity College to study. And again, back then, of course, medicine was a different route. Everybody, people would have gone and done a liberal arts degree initially, or a BA in the classics, and then gone on to either go through, the apprenticeship route or whatever else, and gone through their medical training and then gone on to sit their exams. But Louis Byrne is connected, I suppose, in many respects to the great and good of Dublin City, because he marries into a wealthy family, and his father-in-law is a well-known medic in the city and a philanthropist, and I suppose his own levels of respectability is fairly vicariously achieved. But throughout his 32-year career as coroner to the city of Dublin, and he's about 40 years a surgeon in the city, he earns a very good reputation. And he seems to be a bit of a golden boy in terms of the shift, of course, that happens during the revolutionary period. And he presides over some very controversial killings during, he's not involved in any of the investigations of 1916 of the Easter Rebellion. But the following year, some Republicans go on hunger strike. And in 1917, he's basically called in to carry out an inquisition into the death of Thomas Ashe, who was a Republican leader who died as a result of a botched force-feeding exercise. And of course, the Republicans, Irish Republicans, use it as propaganda, and they publish the inquest, and it's made available across the Anglophone world, much the chagrin of the British Crown forces. And of course, it has nothing to do with Louis Byrne himself. But when other medics are being attacked for their role in force-feeding Republicans, he's left alone. No matter what way the waves of republicanism and nationalism change in the city, he seems to be allowed to his own devices, because he's seen as apolitical in many respects. He's Roman Catholic, so he's part of that, you know, rising Roman Catholic middle class elite in Dublin City. But he himself comes from humble origins, and I don't think he ever forgets that. And he's court, as with any other coroner. And I should clarify here as well that a coroner's court is a court of record. It's not an adversarial court. It is one that has kind of limited powers. It's not a lower court in the judicial system. It's not at all. However, the evidence that's collected at the coroner's court can be used in adversarial courts thereafter, in the criminal courts, if there is a situation whereby there's suspicion associated with somebody who is involved in a court case, or sorry, involved in a coroner's case. So I think other scholars like Elizabeth T. Hearn have observed that really the coroner sets, or any judge for that matter in the criminal courts, sets the tenor, as in T-E-N-O-R, of the type of court that they preside over, and the levels of fairness or perceptions of justice that comes from these courts. It really comes back to the persona of the person who's presiding over it. And so he's very important to all of this. And I think because he was also a surgeon at Jervis Street Hospital, he saw an awful lot of very poor people coming into the hospital as well, and would have been very, it was located in the city centre, and he would have been very much attuned to the social circumstances of the subjects of the court. So I think he was quite sympathetic to the plight of the urban poor in ways that others may not necessarily have been, you know. So he's very important to the story. And in terms of Dublin City itself, you asked about that, the social circumstances in Dublin. It's a very poor city, actually. Like many other European and American cities, you have a situation whereby the elite of the city has the flight to the suburbs that occurs in the late 19th century. And as an urban historian yourself, Roberta, you'll be well familiar with this kind of trend of the denigration of townhouses and their transformation into tenements. And that's largely complete by 1900. And in Dublin city centre, you have quite a large population living in a very small space. Dublin city centre is actually quite small, and you have like 250,000 people living there. And needless to add, the social conditions are dire. It doesn't have the same level of industrialization as Belfast, and the economy itself is pejoratively described as based on biscuits and beer. And so very few families fit that breadwinner model. So the idea of having your idle wife stay at home minding children was something that very few families had. Not even the Guinness workers would have had that level of security. And indeed, there are some studies. Dr. John Lumsden was the company doctor at Guinness's, and he conducted a study in 1903, 1904 in that zeitgeist of like around about £1 a week. And he discovered there were quite a lot of wives of various different you know, levels in the company, not obviously the master brewers, they would have been on bigger money, but say the lower down the pecking order, wives would have kept lodgers to have other forms of cash income coming into households. So if that's happening with Guinness workers, then for people who worked in other sectors, you know, the economic or the financial security of households was always very, very precarious in Dublin at the beginning of the 20th century. And One more point I'd like to make is that I think people think of Joycey and Dublin when you look at the beginning of the 20th century, and everybody's minded of, you know, Buck Mulligan and Stephen Dedalus and all of that. But this is O'Casey's Dublin. This is the Dublin of the tenements. This is the story of the poorest of the poor in Dublin City.
I found it, while reading your book, really the parallel, like between Jerusalem, which is the object of my work, and Dublin, very similar. You have these elites leaving the old city. And at the same time, you have, the idea Europeans look at the old city like through a religious set of lenses. And so they built an idea, but it's not the real city. And the same is like through literature, you look at Dublin and it looks very different from what actually it was. I want to ask you something about methodology, because I found something very interesting in your book. Your book is about power, gender, and class, and it is a work of microhistory, something that I appreciate because I'm a microhistorian. I really love reading microhistories. But it's also, obviously, as we already mentioned, is a book on basically of urban history. Now, while I would love to address all of these approaches, but I'm very curious about a specific concept that you used, and this is the Foucauldian concept of biopower, which, if I remember well, and I think you mentioned also in the book, you really never fully developed. It's something that it comes up with, is developing, but only up to a point. And it's other scholars that picked up this idea of biopower. So I was wondering, how does biopower work in the context of your book?
Well, I found myself, because of the nature of the records I was looking at, that I found myself having to take a multi-methods approach, because urban history alone couldn't carry it for me. And microhistory alone can't carry it, because it's neither singular. I wasn't focusing just on Louis Byrne, because he doesn't leave any papers himself. So I couldn't use him as the object, and do a proper microhistory, as you'd say. I also found, because the records themselves were patchy, that I couldn't actually use the body of records in the way I wanted to, because I would have been wonderful to have had 32 records to use. So I found myself having to pull from a couple of different methodological bases. And why I found biopower particularly useful is that, and as you mentioned, Roberto, it's something that he mentions at his lectures at the Collège de France. He doesn't develop it. In fact, it's other scholars that develop it into the field that we know today in terms of biopower and governmentality. But one of the things he does do is he defines what he means by biopouvoir, and he says that it's an explosion of numerous and diverse techniques for achieving the subjugation of bodies and the control of populations. And I found that I could use that to classify the kinds of data I was working with. And I found it useful to mobilize Aloysius Byrne as an agent of biopower, because in a civil registration of death in Ireland, you have three people. You have the deceased, you have the informant, and you have the registrar. And under the legislation, the informant in coroner's cases is the coroner, or the office of the coroner. So you'll find that and I tried to interoperate the data from the coronial court inquiries and the civil registration of deaths. And it was, and it really came down to the source material itself, Roberto, as to how I could reclassify these data as elements of biopower, as instruments of biopower, because they really are. I mean, for a lot of the cases I was looking at, the records of the life event, which was the death, was the only evidence of that person ever having lived. Because civil registration of births, deaths, and marriages comes into play for Irish Roman Catholics in 1864. But even in 1900, like one of the first cases of Louis Byrne's tenure is of a 26-year-old man whose birth isn't registered. It should have been registered. But of course, for Roman Catholic sensibilities, having a baptism was more important than engaging with the civil registration side of things. So there's a dichotomy going on in what we might term the traditional Irish mindset of not recognising civil instruments and recognising the instruments of the Roman Catholic Church, which might sound familiar to you as well, Roberto.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Growing up in Italy, I learned a lot about the Catholic Church.
I think you might have.
I want to start talking about the chapters, but you know, I normally take you know, the authors that I interview through the various chapters of their work, but actually with you, I want to do something different because I feel listeners would be better served if we actually talk about some of the major themes that you developed throughout the four chapters of the book. And I really want to start with a question which might sound a bit stereotypical talking about Ireland, but is very central to your book and is drinking culture. Alcohol is a constant presence in essentially many of the cases that you discuss. And so these cases that are, you know, then basically brought to the coroners often involve the consumption of alcohol. And I was just wondering if you can take it from here and tell us about, you know, what does it mean alcohol consumption and what is the role of alcohol in the cases, you know, discussed and, you know, written down by the coroner?
Roberta, that's again a very astute observation on your part, and it is a stereotypical view of Irish people of the drunken Paddy and the drunken Bridget and this, that and the other. And it's something that I found kind of difficult to grapple with myself as an Irish woman, but also, you know, constantly having to kind of combat this it's very much a kind of a British view of Irish people, to my mind, and this idea that it's an Anglo-centric view, really Anglo-American view, because the same kind of perceptions of Irish people was promulgated in particularly say Harper's and Punch, these illustrated weeklies and monthly magazines. And when in actual fact, like if you look at the per capita consumption of alcohol in Ireland, it's not any higher than any other city of the Four Nations Project. And so it's an overstatement of the alcohol consumption in Ireland. And again, Diarmaid Ferrier, Elizabeth Malcolm and others have covered this in their extensive work on temperance and alcohol consumption in Ireland. So I think it's deeply problematic, but it also is in the records. It's a specific question that is asked of certain people who are coming before the courts. Now, there are some cases that quite categorically, you know, happen in a pub, like somebody died while drinking a pint, and you know, or somebody died through violence in a pub, or you know, somebody died because of what we'd now call a sucker punch, of a one punch fight where somebody was drunk and hit somebody and they hit their head off the ground, and it's all terrible, and everybody's very contrite, and it's an unfortunate situation. These are unquestionably, they involve alcohol consumption without question. But I found myself having to go further, because in the witness statements, there were, you know, people talking about, oh, I only had one drink, or I only had two drinks. or, you know, and actually also it's about your perception of how much drink you've had. If you've engaged in a few drinks of an evening, and you may forget the one or two others, or, but I also found myself thinking around, what was the proof of the alcohol they were consuming if they only had two drinks? And bearing in mind as well what I know about the level of, say, liquidity of cash in circulation and how they could pay for this, maybe they only did have one or two drinks. But were they drinking poaching, which is the equivalent of moonshine, you know, or were they drinking a glass of Guinness, which was very obviously a very important beverage at the time? And but I wondered about the gravities of or the proof of the alcohol that they were drinking. And I found kind of about 20 years later, cases coming before the courts in the 1920s, as in the criminal courts, of methylated spirits dealers, being brought before the criminal courts for selling alcohol that has like unknown proof, that's industrial strength alcohol, basically. But the problem in inner city, particularly around the north side of the city, is that there are quite a number of what we would call shebeens, which are unlicensed premises, peddling alcohol, and sometimes it's adulterated and sometimes it's not. Now, that's only a small fraction of the cases, but in instances where, you know, it's a case of a child who died as a result of, say, burning or scalding in a household, if the household is stable, if it's a married couple, the father is out working and the mother is looking after the children or whatever, and there's a perception of respectability there because it's considered a strong household in some respects, then there's no, the level alcohol consumed is not in question. But if it's a case of a single parent, either a single father or a single mother, now to a lesser extent, single fathers come into the equation. But the question of alcohol consumption is asked in those cases. And I found that manifestly unfair, obviously, full of bias and kind of prejudicial thinking on the part of police, jurors, and everybody else involved in the criminal court inquiry. So I felt I had to push it that little bit further, Roberto, and that's why I devote quite a bit of time in the book to it, because I think it's something, there are myths that need to be dispelled, but there's the centrality of not just alcohol consumption, but the public house to Irish social life, because for men, it's a marker of masculinity, of respectability, to be able to go to a pub and stand a round of drinks, which means to be able to buy a round of drinks for your friend. And this drinking in rounds is something that Diarmaid Ferreter in particular talks about in his work on the Irish Pioneers Association, as being kind of a mark of respectability and masculinity, but also in work on Irish labour law, the pub was where you got a job. So if you were a general labourer and you were working on the docks in the north side of the Liffey, you went to the pub to meet the gaffer or the ganger and the person who arranged the work, perhaps maybe going on a steamship or working on the docks for, you know, short periods of time. And in many respects as well, Desmond Greer has found in his work on Irish labour law that not only was work organised in the pub, but men were paid in the pub. So if you weren't a drinker, there was certainly peer pressure to be a drinker, because you would have to buy a round, you would have to buy the gaffer a drink for his favour and his consideration for the next job. So there's a saying in Irish, fitta fúta, which is a lovely kind of it is what it sounds like. It's intertwined. So drinking and drink culture and the pub is intertwined in the lives of men in particular at the beginning of the 20th century. So there's no escaping it. And of course, in the case of Guinness workers, part of their payment was in pints of Guinness. So they were allowed 2 pints of Guinness a day as part of their payment. And you were seen as a bit of a square if you didn't indulge. So, but some men actually did get what was called a scrip, where they didn't drink the 2 pints and they brought the money home. But of course, they were probably seen as, you know, under the thumb or, you know, a bit square, you know, if they didn't partake. But I know, you know what I mean, Roberto. I see you smiling away there.
No, that was fascinating. When I was reading the book and I found out that actually workers were paid in, you know, Guinness, I was very surprised. But I guess it made sense in a way, like, you know, you're working there. And again, because you're talking about this culture where drinking is part of a social environment, where obviously, you know, you're just also paid in that kind of coin. And you mentioned that the pub is very central. And I found the pub, when reading the book, central, sort of a connection between the domestic environment and the work environment. And so I wanna talk about now the domestic setting, which is one where actually people die. It's not where only people live. And there are a number of cases that you discuss where people have died at home. And so can you tell us what the coroner's reports tell us about the domestic environment in Dublin? And perhaps you can also tell us something about the question of child neglect, which I found extremely troubling to an extent. And how were people, mostly mothers, judged by both the court and the neighbours?
Yeah, the domestic context is architecturally for children, physically, it's a very dangerous space. And if you're living in a tenement setting in a household that was probably designed with one family in mind in the late 18th century, you know, by the close of the 19th century, with no upkeep, etc., a lot of these buildings are very decrepit. In fact, some collapse, and there's devastating consequences. And later than my book deals with, but not that much later, it's only in 1913, but there's a case where a couple of tenement houses collapse on Church Street, and quite a number of people die. But that's an extraordinary context. But in the ordinary and in the everyday, there are several cases. And I understand what you mean about very troubling. And I think there's a content and a trigger warning here for everybody, because the cases are very unsettling, particularly when you consider the number of children who die as a result of burning and scalding in rooms that were never designed as cooking spaces. And, like, you know, I found myself reading the coroner's inquests. My data set is of 611, I should say that, and they centre around the 1901 census, so a year before and a year after. And I do that because I was able to kind of use the 1901 census returns as an anchor as well, and also as part of those an instrument of biopower. It's a way in which I could anchor these very, very poor families and examine their lives over a small period of time. And there was one case of a little girl who had been born to her mother prior to her current relationship marriage, by the time her daughter died. And that child, even though she was four, Katie McLaughlin was her name, and she was four in 1901, it was 1901 that she died. And there was no record of her, no civil registration of her birth, but neither was she accounted for in the 1901 census that had occurred a couple of months before her death. So she is kind of a poor child who is, I think, perhaps a bit neglected. And unfortunately, she dies as a result of burning in, again, a room that was never designed to be a cooking space. So needless to add, like, cooking spaces were problematic for children, small children, to be around. There were no fire guards, and that was something that Louis Byrne was quite exercised about. And he takes it up kind of throughout his career, and he's trying to encourage landlords and the Dublin Corporation to, you know, make it part of the rules that you had to add fire guards in rooms with children, etc., etc. And of course, it's not just children who die as a result of burning, like women, older women in particular. I have a case of an older woman whose dress caught fire, and she was unable to get away from it. And it's a terrible case of her grandchild was in the room with her, and the neighbors heard banging on their ceiling, which was the child inconsolable because basically his grandmother is alight in the room with him, and he's terrified. And it's an awful, awful case, but it makes you think about, and particularly writing this book during a cost of living crisis and a housing crisis, not just in Dublin, in all Irish cities, and globally for that matter, of overcrowding, and particularly as we're still in the middle of a global pandemic, the inability to cordon off already very small spaces for social isolation. What do you do in a household where there's 10 people or 15 people and you have two rooms? And let's face it, in a lot of migrant households, that is the case, you know, particularly for young migrants. You know, they tend to heap up on top of each other. They don't really care because they're young. But then throw a public health problem in there, and you have difficulty and you have an issue. And in Dublin, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a slower burning endemic disease of tuberculosis, and people really succumbed to that. And other respiratory illnesses were really prevalent in Dublin at the beginning of the 20th century. And of course, as well, you know, these poorly ventilated, and of course, they weren't opening windows because, you know, you're leaving out the heat if you open the window. You see deaths that are quite seasonal as well in the coronial courts. So deaths by fire happen predominantly in kind of colder weather. And again, you mentioned at the outset, Roberto, you know, the judgment of women. I think that if a mother leaves a child in a room with a fire, look, you can't watch children all the time. I think most parents or anybody who's looked after a small child, you turn your back for a second, anything could happen. There's an element of luck here. But in cases where mothers left children in rooms where there were fires lighting, they were more kind of susceptible to a very critical gaze from the perspective of jurors. And sometimes it was very unsympathetic. And again, respectability indicators come into play here. If it was a single mother, they were judged more harshly. If it was a mother who had any kind of reputation for having taken drink, again, judged more harshly. And there was one case where a father was asleep in another room, the case of Isabella Woodcock. And he was a sorter in the GPO. He had been on a night shift. Mother went next door to go to the grocer's next door to get some soap, I think it was. She was gone for like a minute or two. And when she came back, her child was on fire. The child's clothing was on fire. And she had left her two small children alone in a room where there had been a fire lighting, but her husband was in the room next door. And when the police come later on that day, to take statements and whatnot, he makes an allegation against her of having been a drinker. And to be fair to the constable, the Dublin Metropolitan Police Constable, who was attending to the case, he investigated it further, and he actually said, look, there's no evidence whatsoever that this woman was a drinker. But it was such an easy thing to do, to besmirch the reputation of that woman by making the allegation of being a drinker. So it's not just, you know, kind of British and American views of the Irish, it's the Irish, views of themselves as well, this kind of falling into that stereotypical view and just kind of turning it against women in particular is really, I found that fascinating, Roberto, particularly in the records that I came across.
I want to move to the outdoor. Now, we talked about alcohol, which certainly may have exacerbated you know, certain situations that eventually led to the death of individuals, including children. But I had the feeling that the real danger in Dublin was actually represented by the street and its traffic, perhaps something that didn't change ever since.
Yeah, Roberto, again, as an urban historian, you will appreciate this, I think, a lot. I mean, I look at 1900 to 1902 in particular, and around that time, the last of the trams become electrified in Dublin. And because of the presence of these electric trams crisscrossing the streets, it shoves other vehicular traffic into smaller streetscapes. And so you have these big, powerful horses, these draft horses, driving H cars or hackney cars down much smaller streets. And children in tenements use the space outside the front door as an extension of their households. And they're very much in danger there, and probably weren't attuned to, I think perhaps with other ambient noise in the city, probably didn't hear shouts of warning to get out of the way, or, you know, young children are probably oblivious to everything else except what they're playing with, and probably didn't hear, you know, parents or guardians or older people or other children shouting at them to move out of the way. I think for tram drivers, there's quite a number of cases of tram drivers knocking people down. I have 38 cases in total of people are being knocked down. And for me, I think when I was looking, before I started really investigating this, I was thinking, why didn't they hear, you know, a bell or the sound of oncoming hooves or, you know, a tram? Surely you would have heard it. And then when you think about it a bit further, if there's other competing sound, you're not going to hear the sound of hooves. You're not going to hear the sounds of bells or shouts, you know, because there's so many other competing sounds in a city. And I think that that's something that's probably lost to history, is the soundscape of early 20th century Dublin. We don't know what it sounded like. And I think that, you know, when the talkies come about in the 1920s and 30s, and there's actually, you know, sound captured in the city, you know, I had no frame of reference, if you know what I mean, Roberto. I'm not sure if there's anything that exists for Jerusalem at the beginning of the 20th century, but, you know, the history of sound is something I think that really deserves more attention from urban historians. But it's that cusp of modernity, really, isn't it? Between and of course the arrival of bicycles and motor cars as well. If you look at the colonial court records kind of a few years later, it's motor cars that are causing deaths as well, because I think there's a confusion around the rules of the road, around traffic speeds, and pedestrians expect trams and cars to stop for them. Like, I don't know if you've ever found when you come to a new city, you're not used to the convention. Do I walk or not? Or like, do I stop? Do I go? And I think that there's an element of that going on as well. And I've quite a few cases where people are kind of corpus mentis enough after they're injured and they say, well, I expected him to stop, or, you know, there's an uncertainty about the rules of the road. And unfortunately, when you're hit by a horse or a tram, you know, the longer term prospects are not good. So people die from internal hemorrhaging, particularly adults. Children are invariably, unfortunately, killed on the spot, and they die fairly soon afterwards. So they're not giving evidence. I didn't have any evidence of a child saying anything, but there's evidence of witnesses saying, oh, I heard the driver say, you know, move up, pull back, whatever, or shouting at the children to get out of the way. And of course, for middle class reformers, it's the nuisance of children playing football on the streets. Where else are they going to go? There's nowhere else for children to play in Dublin City at the beginning of the 20th century, until such a time that there are playgrounds constructed specifically for them. So it's an unfriendly space for children, but it's also, there's a huge sense of community in Dublin City. And that was one of the things that I really came across in the records, was that people looked after one another, no matter how poor they were. The poor looked after the destitute, and strangers, in contrast with, say, mothers in the home, where if a death occurred in a domestic context, mothers of a child, mothers were definitely under scrutiny in terms of blame. But when deaths occurred outside the front door, everybody was responsible for those children around. So there was a small let up on the pressure in terms of the blame that could be put on mothers. So, and I found that a little bit refreshing. So I also used the threshold as the front door as a marker in my study, because I felt it was important to distinguish between deaths inside and outside of the home.
Let me move to your final chapter. Now, this is the one that I found the most disturbing in terms of the stories that are recollected. But I also want to say that, particularly for the readers, that, you know, your narrative keeps the reader at one arm's length from sort of the violence that occurs in the environment, but there's also a good deal of empathy. So it's kind of like you can read it through from an academic perspective, but at the same time, you're not fully detached from the stories. And I found it very, very important. Now, you talk about the unnatural, suspicious, and violent deaths. And I'm interested in the role of law, religion, traditions, particularly in order to understand the other key term that permeates your work, and you just mentioned that, blame.
Yeah, blame is obviously a very important, is an important concept when you're looking at any kind of court records. And I mean, it's the purpose of the adversarial courts to blame somebody or to, you know, to punish somebody who is to blame for a particular crime or to exonerate them. And for the final chapter, one of the reviewers said, you know, you need to put this first because you need to hook your reader. And these are the most interesting cases. And I was thinking, gosh, if I put that first, I'll terrify people and they'll run away from me. And I'm glad you agree, Roberto, with that. So I divided the cases basically into deaths of infants. So cases of suspected infanticide, cases of suicide, and cases of manslaughter or manslaughter or homicide. And there were some incredibly violent deaths in there, and some cases that I had to kind of retrospectively kind of recategorize, say cases that were very clear cases of self-harm that were rendered into an open verdict to, I think, again, coming back to one of your original observations, Roberto, for more for the living than for the dead. So to preserve the good name of a family, the jurors would return a verdict that a writer, I should say. So the verdict is medical, by the way. It's usually verbatim what the medical expert says the cause of death is. But in cases of self-harm or suicide, usually it says, you know, what instrument was used or how the death occurred, whether it was by hanging, whether it was by you know, the various different methods employed. Drowning was a favored one. So in all cases where an adult body was found drowned in Dublin and elsewhere, and similar to cases in Australia, other studies of Australia and New Zealand found that drowning was a favoured method because not everybody swam back then either at the beginning of the 20th century. So it was a way of doing the deed. And what the jurors would do, they would add a rider saying, and we have no evidence to show. So that way there is an exoneration of the subject of the court. So, or else they would use while temporarily insane. And again, that comes back to, the religiosity of it all, and how suicide was viewed both in legal terms and in religious terms. The Roman Catholic Church refused to allow victims of suicide to be buried on consecrated ground. But usually that's canon law. But the interpretation of that by Irish priests would have been different. And it gave priests that little bit of an out if a jury came back with, and we have no evidence to show, or while temporarily insane. Now, in other countries, there would have been implications for insurance, health, life insurance policies, and this, that, and the other, but less so in Ireland. Because, and particularly in this very poor data set, we're talking about very poor people here who don't have lives insured invariably. And in fact, in any of the cases of infanticide or suspicious child deaths, one of the first questions that's asked is the child insured? Because there's this idea, which was, of course, popularized in the 1980s by Reagan, of the welfare queen almost idea of, you know, they're on the make. They're not on the make. There might have been one out of, say, 500 cases of insurance fraud. And I did look to see if I could find records of insurance companies, but unfortunately, they're not extant. So I have very little evidence to support this claim that there is massive insurance fraud happening. It's not. It's simply not. You know, so one case is blown out of proportion in order to support this classist idea that the poor are mean to their children. They're absolutely not. You know, there are some cases of neglect and cruelty without question, but they're in the minority. I found this chapter very difficult to write. It took me a long time. And once I'd written it, I sat with it for about a year. And because I felt I had to locate the various types of death in their legal instruments. So for infanticide, there's a set of legislation for that and punishment or whatnot. And under bastardy and infanticide laws. And then in terms of suicide, you have to deal with the legal instrument. And of course, not every law that's passed in Westminster is brought into Ireland. So I found myself having to look into burial law, law associated with forfeiture, and also looking into insurance and this, that, and the other. And then for the homicide cases or the manslaughter cases, those cases I found particularly depressing, to be honest with you, because there's so few cases of murder, first of all. And so to me, again, coming back to this idea of biopower, the poor are afraid of the surveillance of the state, and also afraid to engage with the police or the legal instruments that, say, middle class or upper class people might engage with. They're not going to call the police because they have to live in the areas that they're in. If there was a case of a mother and daughter, I think you might remember that case, Roberto. And what I think, to me, again, there's very little records to back this up here. Because let's face it, local bully boys don't keep their memoirs. But there is a degree of, I think, probably some maybe gang mentality going on here, bully boy tactics, the strong man of a community, et cetera, probably a bit of extortion and protectionism going on as well. But there's no way of getting at that history. And how we view it is through records of the court. And that's only it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of criminality. So it was difficult to use the records to kind of push them as far as I could to get a sense of how blame is allocated. And what I found was, particularly in the coroner's court, women were more likely to be blamed than men. Men are, you know, particularly if they have full-time jobs, or they're perceived as good men in the community. I'm seeing them literally get away with murder in these records, and both the murder of children and women. And, you know, aren't they mighty men all the same? And, you know, they end up getting like 3 or 4 months, because judges see them coming before the courts, and they're like, okay, if I leave this man in prison for a year or two, that's taking the breadwinner out of circulation, and I'm going to plunge that family into poverty. And there is a lot of compassion in the courts as well. And you have to remember, around this time, there is an increasingly nationalist kind of outlook in Irish society, particularly in Dublin, and there's a rising Catholic middle class as well. So, yeah, there's a heady mix of kind of religion, and there's a localization of the interpretation of laws that are passed in Westminster, and how they apply to Dublin is a matter of discretion. First of all, at the hands of the police, and then afterwards at the hands of the courts. So it's not a linear thing. And, you know, I found that in some of those really awful cases, Roberto, that the outcome was a fine of 20 shillings for somebody who had starved a child to death. Really? Are you kidding me? And, you know, a man being sentenced to less than 12 months after he had, like, you know, it was a case of manslaughter, but he killed his child, you know, and who had stood between a young boy who had stood between an abusive man and his wife. And this young boy was trying to protect his mother, and he was killed at the hands of his own father. He was drunk. It was accidental. It was all of those things. But he ended up serving just a couple of months because the census returns show us he was out within 3 months. You know, so it's a little bit of plus ça change as well, because when we look at violence against women in society right now, I again see there's very little change. There's a lot of criminality, violence, domestic violence that remains underreported or doesn't get to the courts because of fear of, you know, making matters worse. And unfortunately, in the cases of domestic violence, women die at the hands of abusive men.
Now, as we reach the end of the interview, I just have one question, but it's divided in two. So I was wondering how this book has been received since it's been published, and maybe you think will be received in the future, in Ireland in particular, given it paints a rather grim picture. One that, and you talk about this in the book, that the post-independent independence governments were not really eager to discuss. And the other side of the question is perhaps we can really end discussing what is the legacy of death that was reported by Dr. Byrne in Irish History and Society.
They're excellent questions, Roberto. I mean, the first thing I would say is that one of the things I found with regards to the Dublin City Coroner's Court, it had a seamless blending with the city, the cadence of city life. And that's why it hasn't formed part of Irish historiography until now, really. Very few historians have looked at the coroner's records. And in terms of how this book will be, it has been seen, it's just been reviewed in the Irish Times and kind of favourably so by Dr. Chris Cusack, which is very generous of him. I'm not entirely sure. That's not for me to answer, really, Roberto. But it shines a light on a very grim Irish history that post-independence Ireland would definitely eschew. Because it's not the type of Ireland that the Irish Free State would have promulgated, as, you know, it looked to the west of Ireland. Indeed, that's where I began as a historian, looking at, you know, the west of Ireland and poverty and development in under the Congested Districts Board from 1891 to 1923, around the same time frame, I suppose, really, kind of this era of nation building. And I think that Dublin inner city, because of its association with being the site of British administration in Ireland, it had a high number of enlistments to British Crown Forces during World War One. It's not where the Irish Free State government looks to as the epitome of, you know, Irishness. It looks to the west of Ireland, that Cynadosh kind of Irish comely maidens at the crossroads, you know, Irish language, little whitewashed thatched cottage, and this, you know, sturdy children, and that this idea of a healthy, happy, self-sufficient rural household. It's not looking to the tenements, which is, I think, begins to be issued. And it's something that I do deal with in the book, because it's not where Gaelic Irishness in terms of the revival is located. And it's quite unfair, because it's something that's really celebrated in the Ireland and in the Dublin of Sean O'Casey, which is a working class urban Irish identity that is no less Irish than, say, Na Gael Gorry from the west of Ireland. And I'm an Irish speaker from the west of Ireland, but it's no less Irish than I am, you know. So this Dublin city identity is, I think, ignored for quite some time. And even so much like, you know, the collection of folklore in the 1920s and 30s by the now National Folklore Archive, which is held at UCD. But the Irish folklore collection initially just collected folklore in rural Irish areas, and it ignored, you know, areas of Northern Ireland as well. Is that less Irish? Is Belfast less Irish than Dublin or Kerry? I think not. You know, so this idea of Irishness, it's a very complicated issue, as you well know, Roberto. Certainly the history that I uncover would not be very popular with, say, the Devalerian concept of what Ireland should be and what families should look like. And of course, things change utterly in the 20s and 30s in Ireland. And the types of people coming before the coroner's court would not have been, you know, the Kathleen Ni Houlihans, or, you know, the celebrated of the idea of the perfect Irish woman and the perfect Irish man, you know, that. And of course, these identities change, like the drunken Paddy, the drunken Biddy, these ideas change as well from 1900 onwards, and indeed from the World Fair in Chicago. You know, there's this kind of reinvention of what the Irish Colleen is, and that happens at the close of the 19th century. But she's rural, and she's pure, and she's a particular type of Irishness. So I think I don't think Ireland's unique in that way. And there's always this idea of Irish exceptionalism, which really bothers me as well. I think that lots of nations try to articulate a particular identity at the beginning of the 20th century. Sometimes it's articulated through the body of women. And Ireland has always been feminized. It's Banba, it's Kathleen Ni Houlihan, it's a female figure, whereas John Bull is brutish and male and British and whatnot. You know, so this articulation of Irish identity mediated through the body of women is a really interesting one. And Mother Russia, Mother India, you know, it's a really interesting concept, and something that hopefully sometime in my career I'll deal with more. But you're absolutely right, Roberto. This is not the type of Irishness that would have been very popular with John Charles McQuaid or De Valera in the 40s and 50s. Definitely not.
This was Professor Kira Bernac, author of Ordinary Lives, Death and Social Class, Dublin City Coroner's Court, 1876-1902, published by Oxford University Press in 2022. Kira, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto.